This is the State of Things from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. Last spring, Juana Ortega walked into a church in Greensboro hoping to avoid deportation. She may have started a movement. Since then, at least five other immigrants have sought sanctuary in North Carolina, and a growing number of churches plan to open their doors as well. Today, we're taking a deeper look at this movement, its origins, its goals, and the leaders who have decided to take a stand. One of them is Reverend Julie Peoples. She's a senior pastor at Congregational United Church of Christ in Greensboro, and she joins me now. Julie Peoples, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tell us more about your church's involvement in Sanctuary. How did this conversation get started?
We really started this conversation in earnest a little over a year ago when it became clear with the new administration that the rules were changing, that immigrants and refugees were going to be targeted increasingly, that basically all immigrants were being labeled criminals. So we began to hear stories of families afraid to go to the grocery store to send their children to school for fear that someone would be detained and deported. We knew we had to respond in some way, and we're very disturbed at the stories we heard, very disturbed that, in particular, it was people of color being targeted. And as a predominantly white congregation, we felt called by the gospel to respond. So we began to study and learn everything we could about Sanctuary and whether we could do it. We asked a lot of questions, consulted attorneys, and gathered information. Had a lot of discussions, a lot of prayer, a lot of discernment, and came to the conclusion that yes, we were indeed called to this. We at a are a church that has always believed in radical hospitality and welcoming absolutely everyone, and this fit perfectly with our history. It was just a logical continuation of our ministry. And when we heard first of Minerva Garcia's story and her needs and her children, our response was, how can we not open our doors to her? So Minerva was with us for 3 months until a judge vacated her order. And then Oscar Canales joined us last month.
We're going to speak with Oscar Canales in just a moment and talk more about him and that decision. But tell me what you learned legally. What is Sanctuary? Is it a legal distinction? Is it a policy question? How does it work?
The law strictly says that people are forbidden to hide, to harbor, to shield from detection anyone sought by law enforcement, and they are forbidden to transport. In the new Sanctuary movement, which has been going on about 12 years in this country, we, by and large, are not harboring, we're not hiding. So the first thing we do is tell ICE that the immigrant is with us. There is a policy in place that has been for years, that is not a law, that considers churches, school, faith communities, schools, and hospitals a sensitive location, which means ICE is to take a hands-off approach. They are not to enter. Now, that is policy. It can change at any minute. And across the country, we are seeing Sanctuary leaders, the ones in Sanctuary, who are being targeted. But for now, that policy is, to our knowledge, still in place.
Tell us about Oscar Canales, how he came to your attention.
We learned about Oscar and his family through the American Friends Service Committee, a wonderful local organization. Oscar came here about 12, 13 years ago in search of hope. He was from a very, very impoverished and troubled area in El Salvador, and he wanted a future. He is here. He is a business owner. He is raising, with his wife, raising three marvelous, beautiful children. And Oscar was given a deportation order back in the late fall. So, believing that we should not be separating families, we should be, as a people of faith and as a nation, we should keep families together, we welcomed Oscar into our Sanctuary in the middle of January.
And he's living at the church now.
He is living at the church now. There are several rooms set aside for our immigrant guests and a room for volunteers. His family is there quite a bit, and we enjoy having them even as we grieve that they need to be there.
Well, Oscar Canales joins us now by phone. He is in Sanctuary, Congressional United Church of Christ in Greensboro. And as Reverend Peoples said, he is the father of three. He owns a roofing company, had been checking with ICE annually for the past 4 years before he got that order to leave last month. Oscar Canales, welcome to the program. Good to talk with you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good, you know, but the first thing, you know, I'd be really happy, you know, with these people's at the church, they really opened the door for us. And I can say I've been doing good, you know, because I can be able to see my family, you know, and every day, most I can say, you know, and I can still run my business, you know, and but it's not easy, you know, to being here, you know. Sometimes I feel like I'm going to go out, you know, and keep doing what I was doing before.
What is a typical day like for you? What do you do every day?
Most of the time, you know, I have my baby with me every day in the morning, and you know, and I make a phone calls from here, you know, and just get up and you know, and stay in here, you know. So.
And what's it like for your? Forgive me for interrupting. What's it like for your family?
It's really tough for my family, you know, because and they can we cannot get used to this life like this, you know, and it's really tough for my family, you know, because I know we're there, you know, every day. So, you know, and I hope this is not worse than what it is right now, you know, but and it's really tough for us.
So. What would it be like for you if you went back to El Salvador? What would happen?
Well, you know, if I don't plan to go back, if I go back, you know, to El Salvador, you know, it's a dangerous country. You know, I don't want to bring my family over there. That's completely separate the family, you know. And if I go back there, you know, it's dangerous. You know, if they know you come from United States and, you know, and it's a bad criminal people over there right now. You know, you really cannot trust on police over there.
And you're running a business. You have a business. You employ people. You're paying taxes, right?
Yes, I do. You know, right now I have 6 employees.
And you're still able to keep the business as long as you're safe now at the church, I guess.
Yes, thank you God for that. You know, and I have someone outside, you know, who's running my business. And you know, yes, I had to do a phone call from in here. And thank you God, we're running the same, you know, and we're doing good. And so the only thing is, you know, and I cannot go out, you know, and I'm ministering my business like I was.
Were you surprised when the people from the church reached out and offered you a place to stay?
I really, you know, I was surprised, you know, and I did not know much about this, you know, but until we went online, you know, and I started to see, you know, how many good people exist in this country too, you know. You sometimes, you know, you're like, you have a bandage on your eyes, you know, you cannot see nothing, you know, and until these people open the door for you, we're really happy with that.
Well, I'm going to ask Reverend Peoples a question here now, and Reverend Peoples, ask you, what kind of reaction has there been, any pushback, any backlash about your decision?
We have received so much support from this community, from folks around the country. We did have some backlash when Minerva came in to Sanctuary. There were the nasty emails and anonymous phone calls for a while, but the good really has outweighed the bad by a huge margin, and I believe the other churches currently offering Sanctuary, there are 4 others in this state, have experienced the same. We get checks, contributions from strangers from around the country. Folks from this community walk in and ask, how can they help? How can they volunteer? What can they do? So there has been good support.
Let me ask you about Minerva. She was obviously working and living in this city, in this area. She was ordered deported she was given sanctuary, and as you say, that order was rescinded or vacated, so she's out. How is she doing now?
Minerva is very happy to be back in her home with her three children, Eduardo, who is a DACA recipient, and her two younger children, Mateo and Antonio. She's very, very happy. Unfortunately, several weeks after she was released, ICE reopened a case on her and put an ankle monitor on her. So we have to go to Charlotte every other month for a check-in, and she has another hearing at immigration court next fall, an indication that ICE just simply does not want to give up.
Talking with Reverend Julie Peoples of the Congregational United Church of Christ in Greensboro, also Oscar Canales. He's a local business owner, a father of three, currently in sanctuary at the church in Greensboro. We're going to continue our conversation about the deep history of North Carolina and particularly Guilford County in supporting people who are protecting themselves. And we'll continue that conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. But first, we've got music from our guests, Whiskey Christie and the Half Pint Orchestra.
Oh, God's critters got a place in the choir. Some sing low, some sing higher, some sing out loud on a telephone wire. Some just clap their hands, paws, or anything they got now. Listen to the bass, it's the one on the bottom where the bullfrog croaks and the hippopotamus moans and groans. The big to-do and the old cow just goes moo. Oh, God's critters got a place in the choir. Some sing low, some sing higher, some sing out loud on a telephone wire. Some just clap their hands or paws or anything they got now. Cats and the dogs, they take up the middle where the honeybee hums and the crickets.
This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret at the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. A growing number of North Carolina churches have chosen to provide sanctuary to immigrants threatened with deportation. They house people who are undocumented and advocate for their release. In the meantime, they provide resources for the affected families. Although this concept may be new to some, North Carolina has a history of hosting progressive movements to help vulnerable people protect themselves. We're broadcasting from Guilford County today, which has largely had a large Quaker population settling in this area. In the period before the Civil War, Quakers in North Carolina took an active role in the abolitionist movement. Still with me is Reverend Julie Peoples of the Congregational United Church of Christ in Greensboro. That congregation is currently providing sanctuary to an immigrant who is facing deportation. And joining the conversation now is Gwen Gosney Erickson. She's a librarian and archivist at Guilford College who specializes in Quaker history. Gwen, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us a little bit about some of the deep history of the Friends, Quakers, in this area and their involvement in the abolitionist movement.
Sure. There are interesting parallels with what Julie was just describing in the earlier segment. In the 1770s, Quakers in North Carolina made a committed decision that it was immoral to own their fellow human beings. And at the same time that Quakers were working to bring an end to slavery, the state laws were becoming increasingly restrictive and were not allowing individuals who wished to manumit people they may be enslaving. And if you did manumit, the formerly enslaved person was required to leave the state.
So if you secured the freedom of an individual,
correct.
They were at that point, they were forced to leave the state.
Correct. Yeah. And therefore, in 1808, North Carolina Yearly Meeting, the statewide organization of Quakers in this area, decided to pursue what they could legally, using gray areas, to, as a body, own people in order to allow individuals to be protected by being enslaved so they would not have to leave the state, so you could keep families together, and then working towards ways to allow these individuals to then resettle to freedom by their own agency to then at a later date, as funds and opportunities allowed, go to Liberia or Haiti in the early years, or Ohio or Indiana later on.
But as you point out, as the Friends exploited those gray areas became black and whiter.
Correct. There are a number of court cases documented where individuals were accusing the Society of Friends and of trying to negotiate these of not manumitting for good reason and trying to close some of those loopholes. So there were a lot of suspicions. A lot of times people hear about the Underground Railroad. I like to call this kind of the Overground Railroad, mm-hmm. in that they're using legal means, but it still has some of the similar risk associated of people being captured and re-enslaved. The one advantage this system had with North Carolina Yearly Meeting is because they were the legal owners and enslaved people were considered property, the Yearly Meeting could sue on property rights legislation in order to keep people protected.
Now, I'm going to make a joke, but it's not a joke at the same time. You talked about the Friends making a decision, mm-hmm. that this was, that slavery was wrong and they needed to do something about it. Not easy for the Friends to make a decision, right?
Not at all. This was a many decades process. And you also have, same as many congregations today, some people saying we must do everything regardless of legality or not, and individuals who would be more radical in their steps of assisting fugitives. You had others who said, well, I'm not participating in slavery by owning, I've done my duty. And this system I've been describing was kind of a middle ground of saying, we're going to take steps what we can legally, but still leave our comfort zone.
And the reason that's not a joke is that what we're spotlighting here is a group of people, in this case a church, who said we need to have this conversation at a time when nobody else was even considering the possibility. Slavery was, of course, according to some, ordained by God. So you can imagine the kind of conversation. It was not an easy one to have. It's not an obvious conversation, and that's the point.
Correct.
I'm trying to make. They made it, and again, there's tension within the group. What about the outside community? Was there backlash against Quakers for coming to this decision?
I mean, there definitely was, this was a controversial stance to take. And as I mentioned, people were kind of across the spectrum, both Quakers and non-Quakers. Quakers weren't the only ones. Obviously, there were in Guilford County also a population of a free black community who were also assisting with this process, enslaved people who were taking steps to work with this, and some individuals from other faith communities. But Quakers were really one of the main kind of institutional bodies taking this step. The other thing I like to think about, too, is the time period I'm talking about was primarily in the 18-teens, 1820s, 1830s, still decades before the U.S. Civil War would occur. So that there is no guarantee of how this would turn out. And that creates a real lesson as well for us today of thinking about now. Pretty much everyone says this was a great thing to do, that this happened. I have researchers visit routinely asking about efforts to assist with ending of slavery and providing sanctuary to enslaved peoples. However, at the time, it was highly controversial and often looked down upon.
Well, you make a couple of good points. I want to highlight one of the things you say. This is assistance. People were very much working toward their own protection and their own freedom. And this was a movement that, had it not been for the work of enslaved people, it may not have turned out the way it did. But there was assistance from the dominant community in this decision to assist people already engaged in the process of protecting themselves. That's the point you made. I want to highlight that. Reverend Peoples, let's talk about, again, coming forward now, the other point that Gwen made, which was, at the time, it wasn't obvious how this was going to turn out. We're looking at a situation now with immigrants whose protection and who are extremely vulnerable and who are threatened daily with not being able to live normal lives. Do you see a growing movement? Do you see more churches participating in this, or are churches tending to hold back? What's the landscape at the moment?
This new sanctuary movement, as it's being called, is growing by leaps and bounds. There are now 1,000 congregations across this country who have declared themselves as sanctuary congregations. We have five here in North Carolina, more than any other state at the moment, and we have a half dozen more congregations that we know of that are studying and working their way and making space in order to do this, all of us believing we are following a higher law and answering to that higher law. And we are following the leadership of our immigrant neighbors who are telling us what they need and who are sharing their stories. So again, we are really assisting them.
We're talking about the history of sanctuary churches and recent surge in those seeking and providing refuge here in North Carolina. And we are joined now by Andrew Garces. He's an immigrant rights organizer with the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome to you, Andrew. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
You know, we were talking with Oscar Canales, who is in sanctuary right now, and people used to be safe from deportation as long as they checked in.
Right.
They were working and they stayed out of trouble with the law. Clearly, that's no longer the case. What is that? What are you seeing now from your perch in the Friends Service Committee?
Right. Yeah, there's almost like two different waves of danger now for undocumented people. And one is what we're seeing with Oscar. People like Oscar and all of the people in Sanctuary North Carolina actually are in a similar position where they were required to check in with ICE every year at an ICE office with a deportation officer, and they were doing that. And there were between tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of them. We don't know exact numbers because ICE is fighting FOIA requests. Freedom of information requests, that's right. Who are all in the same situation, who are now being told, after years of being told, you know, you're fine, don't worry about it, you're doing exactly the right thing. Now, you have to buy your own plane tickets to leave the country, or we will deport you by force. So there's that danger that's leading people into sanctuary. And then there's also a dramatic change in behavior by ICE agents on the ground and by Jeff Sessions' Justice Department, which controls the immigration courts. Last year, ICE agents went out into our communities around here, and just in the last year, arrests went up over 50%, and 92%.
Arrests went up over 50%.
Yeah, and okay. That's directly like ICE agents going and arresting people themselves in our communities. And 92% of the people who were arrested in the Carolinas have been deported. So there's no second chances anymore. The immigration courts are not hearing appeals. Most people are just getting deported. Just this month, in one elementary school that we work with immigrant parents around, several parents have been detained and are currently in Georgia in a detention center 15 hours away. And so schools, as a result, are becoming sort of crisis support agencies and having to figure out how do we support now a family that doesn't have a breadwinner, and now the kids are needing a lot of extra support. So, yeah, it's having a dramatic impact here.
I want to talk about the schools and some of the other impact, but I want to get back to something you said. Arrest rates go up 50%. Now, it is a crime to be in this country without proper documentation. So that right. Are there any other criminal charges that are accounting for the increase in arrest rates?
It's actually not a crime to be in this country without documentation. It's a civil violation. So that's not a criminal violation. So there is a big difference in the law. And actually, the Trump administration has been trying to change that definition without going through any kind of lawmaking process. So they are now describing people who have overstayed their visas or entered without inspection as being criminals, but that's not actually true. Mm-hmm. So, and last year alone, there was a series of big nationwide raids where they would pick up a lot of people all at once. And consistently, we saw about 70% of the people they picked up during these raids, which ICE touted in their press releases, 70% of the people were what they call collateral arrests, meaning they weren't even being looked for by ICE. They just happened to be nearby. So we're seeing that more and more in our communities.
And talk more about what impact this is having. Let's start with the schools. Again, you started to describe this. What does this mean? What's happening in schools? What does it mean for teachers and administrations and other students?
Yeah, it's pretty dramatic, and we have a great school system here. The Guilford County Schools Administration has worked with us and with other agencies to provide trainings and services to immigrant parents, Spanish-speaking parents in the county, and other immigrants who are targeted. But we're often seeing that, you know, we get calls from guidance counselors who say, "So I think this person's dad just got picked up. Where is he now? Do you think he's coming back? what immigration, you know, do you have a number for an immigration attorney? And just last week, I was talking with one guidance counselor here at elementary school where they were hosting a fundraiser to pay the light bill for one family. And then they were going to move on to figuring out how to keep her from being evicted next month because the only breadwinner in the house is detained and is probably going to be deported.
And you're putting your finger on another important point. The people we're talking about, by and large, have jobs. So one way or another, they're paying taxes. And if they're renting or owning property, they're paying property tax. They have, if not a social security number, a tax ID number. When those people leave, I guess there's if all you cared about was the financial toll on your community, that could be significant.
Absolutely. All the studies show that recently arrived immigrants pay way more into the system than they take out. And most, you know, undocumented people are paying social security. They're paying federal taxes without any hope that that will actually get them somewhere one day, but just hoping that some point this country will open its eyes and say, you know what, we value your contributions too.
What are the financial tolls on families? You talked about not being able to pay your rent if the breadwinner is either in sanctuary or has been deported.
Yeah, it's usually a detention causes an immediate financial crisis, and this has been our biggest hole that we've struggled to fill here is where do we refer people consistently in order to pay their rent because it can cause eviction very quickly. Utilities, food pantries, you know, they're consistently, there's availability, but there are restrictions on a lot of services to people who don't have Social Security numbers. So, and immigration attorneys cost, so minimum, if they want to file a bond motion to see if we can get them out on bond until a trial, if they don't already have a deportation order, that's $2,000 minimum. If it's full representation of someone who is detained, we're talking at least $9,000.
There's been a push to include local law enforcement in the deportation process. There's some law enforcement agencies seem to want to participate, others don't. Can you give us the landscape, at least locally here in North Carolina?
Sure, absolutely. And it does change sort of sheriff to sheriff that mostly we're talking about county jails which are controlled by sheriffs are the primary way that immigrants are picked up in local law enforcement custody. So here in Guilford County, for instance, the sheriff, if ICE requests that the sheriff hold someone beyond the date that they would have gotten to bond out or whatever it is, they'll say no because now five federal courts have said that that's unconstitutional. But if ICE agents show up at the jail to take custody of someone, then the sheriff will let that happen. So as the sheriff's own words, he says it's the luck of the draw.
Mm. Whereas, if you had been picked up on some other on a charge,
exactly.
Perhaps you were in jail, you make bond, you get a call from ICE, say, hang on to him.
Right.
It's illegal to do that because this is why you're here for this crime and has nothing to do with immigration. Courts have already ruled on that. But you're saying in some cases the sheriff will say, sorry, that's illegal, I got to let him go. In other cases, they're not.
That's right. In many counties across the state, here locally, Davidson County, Forsyth County, there are a bunch of counties around ours in Guilford that will honor what they call an ICE detainer. But at the same time, still in Guilford, there is danger. If you are booked in for any minimum thing, if you're domestic violence charge could be anything, and ICE just happens to be around, they can take you into custody. And that's exactly how Oscar ended up in detention the first time around in 2012, was exactly through getting booked into the county jail. Actually,
minor traffic accident.
Yeah, and he was actually picked up because his name, there's a warrant out for a different Oscar Canales when he got in this traffic accident, but they put him in jail and he was picked up by ICE right away. So there is still danger even in places like Guilford County, which tout our sort of sanctuary leanings for immigrants like Oscar.
And the fact that he got picked up after this accident is only tells you that he stayed there when waited for the police to arrive, because that's
right.
What a good
exactly.
citizen would do. You don't run away from an accident, you wait until the authorities arrive, and then
that's
there's
right.
the mistaken identity. Let's talk a little bit more, Reverend Peoples. You talked about this movement seems to be growing, 1,000 churches, I think, nationally,
right.
one way or another, either supporting or sanctuary. Do you get calls now? Are you becoming an advisor to some of these movements, and what advice do you give?
We get calls every week from around the country. There is a national network, and we all try to resource each other. I told someone recently, my husband and I feel like circuit riders, that we're going around the state and talking with any congregation that is interested in learning more, and more are interested in that. There's a recognition that the numbers are likely to increase greatly in the coming months, and so the need is there. and the awareness that there are so many people whose stories we don't know about, who are being detained and deported and who are at risk every single day. So this has become part of the work that I do to try and encourage more congregations, whether you receive someone into sanctuary, support a sanctuary congregation, or get involved in local agencies like Faith Action or American Friends Service Committee. There are many ways. Become part of a rapid response team. There are lots of ways to become involved in this movement.
And I guess for the members of your congregation, it's a way of becoming more intimately familiar with the individuals who are our neighbors. Sometimes we're divided by culture and language, but since there's a ministry here, people come in contact, huh?
They absolutely come in contact. What we are learning as we do this work, this ministry, is that all of us need sanctuary in one way or another. There are folks for whom coming and spending a few hours a day staying with Oscar, that becomes their refuge. There are folks who are finding a way back into their faith, back into faith communities, because this connects with their deepest values. So we are finding this, that one way or another, we all need sanctuary.
I want to thank all of you for being on our program. Reverend Julie Peoples is senior pastor at Congregational United Church of Christ in Greensboro, currently providing sanctuary to Oscar Canales. Gwen Gosney Erickson is the Friends Historical Collection Librarian and Archivist at Guilford College. And Andrew Willis Garces is an immigrant rights organizer with the American Friends Service Committee. Thank all of you for being on the program. Just ahead, a new group of Congolese refugees helping one another get a fresh start in the triad. And we'll hear that, but first, the music of Whiskey Christie and the Half Pint Orchestra.
Most of my